Welcome to Charting the Course, a podcast from Full Sail Capital, dedicated to providing you with insights, assurance, and confidence to grow and manage generational wealth. Full Sail Capital is a fiduciary registered investment advisor managing more than $1 billion with a focus on integrity, competency, and transparency.
My guest today is Max Rhodes. Max is a wealth management advisor here at Full Sail Capital. In this episode, we talk about the differences in making and managing money. Max provides his insights as he has personal experience tackling this dynamic with high-income earners. I know you'll enjoy our conversation and hope it serves you along your journey. Appreciate you coming by. So like I said, we're going to talk about making versus managing money. Whenever I say that, what kind of comes to mind for you, Max?
Well, I think all of us make money in various ways. Obviously, we are all trained to develop a skill set that allows us to become marketable and either work for ourselves or work for a company and make money. Not all of us manage money, though.
So if you would kind of delineate what you mean with making money and then managing money.
Yeah. So making money is a byproduct of what you've trained all or part of your life to do. It's the income, the saving, the paychecks. That's all part of making money. Managing money is, it requires a different skill set. Just because you have success in making money does not mean you have success in managing money.
If I'm hearing you correctly, there are different skill sets. I'm sure there's some crossover. There's kind of a Venn diagram, if you will. What skills do you see, and it just in that Venn diagram, and you can place them where they go later, but what skills do you see involved in there?
Yeah, so I think whether people realize it or not, in making money, you've got to take a certain level of risk. In a variety of areas, you make certain sacrifices, whereas managing money to be successful in that, it's identifying, you know, areas, risks that you may not want to be taking. Maybe the most successful way to manage money is almost doing, in some instances, the opposite of what you've done to make money.
What do you mean by that? By doing the opposite of what you've done to make money? And I also want to come back to exploring the idea of risk reward in making, because I'm not sure that a lot of people view it through that lens.
The great success stories out there, the videos we see, the news pieces we watch about someone who started from nothing and has risen to great success through whatever method they did. They bet on themselves and they kind of shoved it, all their chips into the middle of the table. And that, while a great story, doesn't necessarily translate if you're then trying to build that wealth. Taking those risks like that would be considered in our profession is a bad idea for the most part.
The idea of risk in your in making money, can you elaborate on that a little bit with regards to maybe entrepreneurs versus a typical employee type job? What goes through your head there whenever you talk about the risks inherent in how you make your money?
Yeah, you know, entrepreneur versus, you know, I think a majority of us when we graduated college going out to work for the big corporation, on the risk spectrum, we're looking at two totally different points on the curve. You've got a walking into a developed business, entry level.
I walked
position.
Into the Army. It was a pretty developed business model.
You've got
me.
You had a few coworkers
just
there.
A little bit.
A great track record of success. I think you guys were 2-0 in World Wars, if I remember correctly.
Back to back.
Yeah. Those are kind of the low end of the risk spectrum. Although looking back, you know, a lot of my contemporaries went and joined Chesapeake thinking this is a low risk, high return probability, and we've seen what happens there. So it doesn't always turn out. Just because you go work for a big corporation doesn't mean your job is secure the rest of your career. Contrast that with entrepreneurs. They amaze me, and I have enough self-awareness to know that I could not function as an entrepreneur in life. I'm not willing to take that level of risk. Certainly those who do repeatedly.
So one of the things that I think entrepreneurs do very well is see opportunities and then go to market quickly, capitalize on them. And again, very unnuanced position, but that's something that they typically do very well. How does that skill set or ability translate to managing money then?
Yeah, so you think about that mindset as they have a singular focus on building their business. That necessarily requires a high level of concentration of time and energy and focus on one thing, which we define in our business as, again, using the same word, a concentration, and something that we try to avoid. They are not diversifying. To really do something well, you focus all your time. You don't necessarily create a plan B or a plan C, and you're not spending time developing maybe another business line in the background to support you while you're focusing on that one goal as an entrepreneur, which is kind of the idea of diversified portfolio management.
In your experience, what do those conversations sound like, and how, what's the range on entrepreneurs who kind of get it to some degree with contrasting the idea that they made a lot of money by concentrating in a single space, and now we are going to put them in a well-diversified portfolio with thousands of positions?
So how does that conversation go?
Yeah. Do you feel like some of them get it, some of them don't? Do they conflate the ideas of making money and managing money?
Well, and let's look at our real estate clients, whether they've made their money in real estate and now we're trying to help manage it, and we're de-risking from the real estate. I think Max can speak into that at a really high level because of the amount of clients that you've worked with who are so highly concentrated in real estate. And I think that's an easy example for us. So maybe if that helps kind of phrase the question of, you know, what has been your game plan or what's been your strategy there?
Yeah, I think it is easier to bring an entrepreneur into the fold of why it makes sense to use an advisor, a fiduciary, because, you know, unlike the real estate profession, entrepreneurs, they'll focus on that and they understand the component of building the business and making the money. But they understand, I think, in my experience, that continuing to grow that money beyond the business is something they don't necessarily have time to do or a desire to dive in and learn the intricacies of money management. Whereas the real estate people I know view it as not only a business to grow, but a source of investment. And I think the ones who have been successful have seen that investment work decade over decade for the most part. And it really goes back to all these biases we always talk about in behavioral finance, investing in what you know. If something has had success, then you're going to continue to go back to the well there. Biases are something we love to talk about in this office internally and have those intellectual conversations, but it's really just sticking with real estate. It's something you can touch. It's something that's tangible. And so that's sometimes a hurdle we have to address initially and explain while you can continue to look at real estate as an investment option. It makes sense to focus in other areas as well, including marketable securities.
I appreciate that. You are a recovering lawyer, as I've heard you say.
That's right.
One of the things, and I use lawyers just as a prototype for high income earners. How many of your either classmates or people in the profession do you feel like struggle with the idea of, I make enough money that I really don't need to worry about managing it well or working with somebody?
A few, unfortunately. And I myself, at least for a part of my time as a practicing attorney, it was kind of the same way. I think that there is a mindset out there that devoting all your time to the almighty billable hour and making your money there will sustain you if you are contributing to maybe your firm's retirement plan and things like that. And that your experience as an attorney, I mean, you went to 3 years of law school, you took a standardized test to get there, you consider yourself perhaps smarter than the average person. And so, you know, maybe going out and if you've read much at all, dumping a little bit of money into S&P 500 fund, you can do that. You don't need somebody to pay to do that for you. I think attorneys who come visit us learn there are things that we do throughout the year that an attorney neither has the time nor the interest to do. And I think maybe the best example is tax loss harvesting. It's just something that you've got to have an interest in and look at the markets pretty frequently to do with any level of success. That's just not there because attorneys are solely focused
on that almighty billable hour, as you previously mentioned.
And taking care of their clients. I mean, that's what it is. That it's draining just like any other professional's line of work.
So I think you might have mentioned it, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. What do you think contributes to that idea of I'm really good at making money, I'm obviously going to be very good at managing money also?
I think people sometimes just lump it all into I am an intelligent person.
I don't put words in your mouth. The idea that I am an intelligent person in this spectrum of life means that I'm an intelligent person when it comes to all spectrums of life. What do you think contributes to that?
I do think it's just the general idea that one is an intelligent person. They can figure things out, not necessarily that they have that knowledge on the front end, but they can read and learn about that particular topic and become proficient in it. I also think maybe there's a sense of pride in certain areas. I think there's a sense of not wanting others to know your entire financial picture. You know, that really goes beyond the
scope. Would you mind sharing yours with us now?
Yes. As well? So last year,
we're going to break down your net worth asset by asset.
Yeah. You know, that doesn't necessarily play into the part of your question about why they think they do it better, but maybe more of why they don't hire somebody.
Yeah. I guess maybe a better question would be what is or should be the role of an advisor as because all people are going to transition from the making to managing whenever they retire. Is that a fair statement in your eyes?
Yes, managing as long as it includes self-management, because some do want to do that, but yes.
So then I guess what should the role of an advisor be in that transition to you?
Going from working to retirement?
Yeah, going from making money to managing money as people stop working and stop receiving a traditional income.
As with anything, just initiating that conversation, asking the right questions, basically doing what you're doing as a podcast host, making someone focus on answering what their annual living expenses may be, looking at maybe dialing down their equity allocation. We use a lot of planning software here that models, you know, the success of a retirement plan. These things are, you could argue, could be intuitive to someone who pays attention to the markets and is willing to spend some time doing some basic calculations, but those aren't really things people think about. They really, in my experience, think more about saving, cutting down expenses in retirement, but not necessarily what their portfolio should reflect.
You know, Max, one thing that I think we like to talk about, or I think we like to make sure we're clear on, is that as a firm and as a wealth management team, we want to help people enjoy this money that they've made, going back to our topic. And so they've worked all these years to make money. And I think sometimes people are reluctant to come talk to us or visit the office because they're worried we're going to say, all right, you can't spend anything else. You
eat. Have $7,000 a year to live off of.
We have some great ramen recipes. How do you handle that conversation? Because I think it's important that people understand we want to help them enjoy it. We just want to help it last as well and accomplish their goals. And everybody's goals are different. But when you're faced with that topic or that pushback, I think that's when I see a lot of people that want to manage their own money because they want to be able to enjoy it. They want somebody telling them no, I guess, all the time. Have you been faced with that? What's your interaction there? What's your conversations at that point?
I absolutely have. I think that conversation is so much easier to have if you have developed a level of trust with that client. Because if you try to talk at someone in a situation where you have not gained that level of trust, they're going to interpret it in the way that you just mentioned, Tyler. If they know that you're coming from a place of, and maybe the conversation is heated, maybe it's, there are disagreements, healthy disagreements, but if they know at the end of the day, you're trying to guide them and help them to a successful retirement, they're going to understand it's not an issue of you telling them not to spend money. It's an issue of living the life they want to live in retirement and the most successful way to do that.
How are you defining successful retirement at that point?
In a couple ways. I think, one, getting an idea of what they plan to spend, what they want to spend, and developing a plan that gets them as close to that number as they can. I don't think a client would consider a successful retirement if they want to travel and, you know, spend X amount a month and you tell them that unless we are willing to take great risks in terms of aggressive investments, you're not going to be able to do that. You've got to talk through those things with them. There's always a risk. when we consider successful retirement, I should define that is through our financial planning programs, it's passing away with at least $1 to your name. That's kind of how it defines a successful retirement. Now, of course, clients can tell us.
And along the lines, accomplishing whatever goals it is, whether that's estate planning or wealth transfer to future generations, buying a lake house, having a boat. Is that what you're saying?
Sure, yeah. The default setting in any plan is, when do you think you may pass and will you have money at that time?
And we're going to talk more about it later, but is the assumption that everyone is going to die?
Yes. I've played with a couple of, I did one for Noah the other day. You may remember him. He built the boat in the Old Testament. We ran one to age 900. And so, yeah, you can play with mortality a little
bit. We were going to talk about estate planning, but yeah, I just wanted to make sure that we are under the assumption that unfortunately everyone is going to pass away.
Yeah. We'll see what Elon Musk does with this Neuralink.
Very true.
As of right now.
So before I go, I wanted to ask you one little bit off-topic question. And I would be curious, what is the worst fashion mistake that you have ever made, Max? You're a pretty fashionable guy. You got to stay in your wheelhouse. So I'd be curious what the worst fashion mistake Max Roach has ever made is.
I would say it was a combination of two bad decisions, which when paired together, this was kind of a 1+1=3 type situation in the middle school years, which are typically a period of time that aren't good for anybody.
Life.
Yeah. I was built like a stick figure back then. And so I thought it would help to buy the biggest jeans known to man. I don't know why I thought that would result in an appearance that I was not a stick figure, but I bought JNCOs, and not just your normal JNCOs, but the JNCOs that hid your shoes, basically. And then I combined that with what we called the butt cut, with the part down the middle and shaved head on the sides. It was scary. I know girls talk to me.
At the time, did you know that it was a mistake?
Oh, no. No. It was strength in numbers back then. And so we all looked terrible. So I guess if enough people look the same way, you can't just make fun of all of them.
Middle schoolers these days are way cooler. They're wearing the high Nike socks. You know, they're way more fashionable, I've noticed. I was as well rocking the JNCOs.
And I feel like we should also be very careful in distinguishing how often you are looking at middle schoolers, Tyler. Could you please provide a context here?
Yeah, I am basing that off of dropping my son off at
there
school.
There we go.
Yeah.
Okay, it is important.
Yep. But they seem really cool. I'd hang out with them. Yeah, absolutely.
I see lots of eras of fashion come back for a second time. And there may be a slight variation to it, but we see the 70s and 80s style come back. I hope
what
that
I hear
never
you say
rears its ugly
is that
again.
You are just waiting for the butt cut to make its return.
I've seen it in movies, but I think the characters that deploy the butt cut are not ones that we are advised to look at like they're wearing something.
On that note, I'll let you get out of here and go get your haircut, Max. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week.